had our Bible reading from. And once you're there, we'll open in prayer. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to share your word tonight, Lord. I just pray that you would be with me and guide my thoughts and my words as I present this message this evening. I pray it would be a blessing and or a challenge to those who are here, and just I pray there'd be something for everyone here this evening. Please guide me and help me. Amen. Back in 2003, so it's a while back now, even though it really doesn't feel like that long ago, a film was released that was quickly gained worldwide fame. It still remains one of the most popular adventure films of today. It was the first installment in the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, and for those who perhaps need a refresher or are completely unfamiliar, story about two unlikely friends, a blacksmith named Will and a roguish pirate named Jack Sparrow, who team up to rescue the governor's daughter, Elizabeth Swan, from some dastardly skeletal pirates and save the world. And they set out to do that, and Will loves Elizabeth, and Elizabeth knows Will loves her, and Will knows that Elizabeth knows that he loves her, and Elizabeth knows that Will knows that she knows that he loves her, but he hasn't told her yet, and it hasn't worked out yet. And the final battle is finished, and the villains are vanquished, and in the aftermath, Will finds Elizabeth and stands there in front of her, and this is the moment to tell her how he feels, and she's waiting because she knows how he feels, and he opens his mouth and says something awkward and lame, like, "We should go back to the ship and tell them all that you're safe." And she's deflated and he's deflated, and off she goes. And as he's standing there, Jack Sparrow, who's rather unhelpfully been just looking at all his plunder in the background, comes staggering over under a weight of treasure and offers the very unhelpful advice, "If you were waiting for the opportune moment, that was it." And off he goes. And it's true. Now, of course, you know, it's a film, so everything resolves itself. But for a while there, Will was tortured by a missed opportunity. And I want to ask you the question tonight. Have you ever let an opportunity slip through your fingers? And if you have a pulse at all, and you're anyway honest, of course you'll answer with a resounding yes. Life is full of lost / missed opportunities. We always, in some way, shape or form, are wondering what could have been. You know, whether our sporting achievements could have been that much better if we'd made that shot, or we'd started just that little bit earlier so our career could have taken off, whether that guy or girl that we once dated was the one that got away, wonder what things could have been like for good or for worse. Perhaps, you know, those arguments that you have, and as they've left, and you think of a really great comeback, you're like, "Oh, really would have put them in there." That's probably a good thing that you didn't say it there and then, but we still think about these things. Ended friendships and fractured family relationships are a big one, a serious one, where we often wonder what could we have done different or better to maintain a relationship that no longer exists. Jobs, careers, pathways that we choose, perhaps something that you invested in or didn't invest in, which is now doing very, very well. I think the fellow who sold Apple was, can't remember who it was, but he's regretting it now because it's taken off massively since he sold it for, I think, like a paltry several thousand dollars. So we always have things, we always wonder what could have been because there's that many choices we make on a day-to-day basis. Now, sometimes it's harmless and it's a bit of fun just to think about, you know, how things could have turned out. But others, you know, we prefer not to remember. And then others, more serious ones, you know, we're twisted with regret and it's painful to think about, because we know that our life could have been very, very different, or a situation could have been much more favourable had we acted or not acted. Now, of course, the ultimate missed opportunity, which makes everything else pale in comparison, is going into eternity without Christ, obviously. And those who do that will have eternity to think about that, and I do not envy them at all. However, for a Christian, it'd have to be pretty high on the list. It must be when we choose to ignore the opportunities that God puts in our lap to witness to others, or to share the gospel, to share Christ, to share God's goodness. I'm saying all this because Hezekiah, if you remember back to our Bible reading, he made such a mistake. The title of my message tonight is Hezekiah, the Christian's Christian. And while it might seem like a bit of an obscure title, hopefully by the end you'll understand why I chose to title that. And we're looking at why we should not strive to be known as a Christian's Christian. That's what I'm trying to communicate tonight. Lessons on why we should not be known as a Christian's Christian. Everything that happened with Hezekiah, this whole base of this message is on a mistake that he made. Hezekiah made a stupid mistake. And my first point is, well, what's the mistake? We're going to look at the stupidity of Hezekiah's mistake to begin with. So we'll read the first couple of verses of Isaiah 39, and we'll take it from there. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. And Hezekiah was glad of them and showed them the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ointment and all the house of his armor and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house nor in all his dominion that Hezekiah showed them not. Then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah and said unto him, What said these men, and from whence came they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, They are come from a far country unto me, even from Babylon. Then said he, What have they seen in thine house? And Hezekiah answered, All that is in my house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them. All right, so this is the mistake that Hezekiah made, and it was a stupid mistake. We all know what Babylon was like. I really don't need to give you much of a history lesson. This is early on in Babylon's existence, so they hadn't yet reached to the heights of their brutality, but you knew what you were getting with Babylon. They were not going to win a People's Choice Award. The King of Babylon was never going to be on Time Magazine's Man of the Year. They were bad people. They were enemies of God. And they were so bad that they were used as a judgment of God on other people. You know, he's got choices. He can send fire, he can send plague, he can send famine, or he can just send the Babylonians. And so it's probably not a great, you know, you wouldn't want to be a Babylonian and you really wouldn't want to be associated with the Babylonians. But they were, on the flip side, they were powerful, they were very rich, and they were very, very influential. They were very artistic. The ruins of Babylon in modern-day Iraq, there's the great sculptures and the structures of lions. They loved their lions and the way they presented them. Dragons, they're all very big on that and their art. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. They were a very, very intelligent people, but they should never have been allowed in to Hezekiah's inner sanctum like they were. And we're going to see why in a little while. Basically, it was the equivalent of opening up your house to someone like Ivan Milat, saying, come on in, check where all my weapons are and my entries and exits and all my prized possessions are. But Hezekiah here, he was obviously flattered by their letters, it says in verse 1. The king sent letters and a present to Hezekiah. And so Hezekiah was probably obviously flattered by this, and he chose to show off everything that he had. He liked having new friends. Now, perhaps the motivation behind why Hezekiah did what he did, commentators are divided, but all of them agree that whether it was Babylon instigating or Hezekiah, the kingdom of Judah, instigating, it was that they wanted each other's help against the Assyrians. They were turning to each other for the big power at the time, which was the Assyrians. But the frustrating thing, I guess, from those who in the know and have the Bible to look at, is that Hezekiah didn't actually need, he shouldn't have known that he didn't need help against the Assyrians, because just in the previous chapter, it's how the Lord sent the angel of death to wipe out 185,000 Syrians camped around besieging Jerusalem. That should have been a really, really strong reminder that he doesn't need earthly alliances when God is fighting for him against his enemies. However, whatever his motivation was, Hezekiah chose to invite them in and show them everything. He showed them all his treasures, and he spared no expense. He showed them everything. Now, why this is such a stupid mistake is that they come, they see, they observe, they gather as much intelligence as they can, and he sends them away with a high five and a wave and a smile without any slight mention of God's goodness. Hezekiah was clearly very, very wealthy, but unlike Solomon, when showing the Queen of Sheba, you know, for the correct motives, Hezekiah, it was all about me and my achievements and look what I've got. And there was no mention of what God had done for him, no mention of God's goodness, no mention of faithfulness. He had pagans in his own house, on his own turf, so an ultimate home ground advantage where everyone around him believes the same as he does and could back him up, and there's no mention of the Lord. He's missed the moment and he has no idea on the seriousness of what he's done or why this is such a stupid mistake. So that's point one, the stupidity of Hezekiah's mistake being that there was no, he missed an opportunity to witness. But we'll unpack it a bit more. Isaiah gets to the heart of it. That's point number two, the searching questions of Isaiah. Verse 3, then came Isaiah the prophet unto Hezekiah and said unto him, what said these men? And from whence came they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, they are come from a far country unto me, even from Babylon. So we'll stop reading there at the moment. And, you know, Isaiah asked questions. What said these men? Whence came they? And what have they seen? These are the three questions that he asks. Searching questions that demand an honest response. Because Isaiah clearly already knows because he was either there or God told him. So Hezekiah can't lie about it. What said these men? That's how he asks. That's his first question. He asks all three questions. He asks two questions and then the third question. But Hezekiah, you'll notice, doesn't actually answer the first question. The question being, what said these men? Hezekiah doesn't give an answer to that. So do we have a concrete, can we unpack this and give concrete, you know, definitively say why he didn't answer? No, we can't. But you know, based on the context and how everything turned out, we've probably got a few ideas. One theory by respected commentators is that what they talk about probably wasn't worth repeating. The Babylonians came in, a very, very wicked, idolatrous people. Perhaps all the talk was about fleshly, wicked things that the king of Judah had no place talking about. Perhaps. We don't know for sure. Perhaps another plausible option is that what they talked about probably had no, it was shallow and meaningless, and as such Hezekiah was embarrassed because to a king talking to envoys, there should be some serious, you imagine if President Trump and Prime Minister Turnbull got together and all they did was talk about what their favourite Slurpee tasted like, something like that. You would you'd be a bit embarrassed by that because you would expect that they'd be talking about things that were important, things that would lead to the benefit of both countries. And then a third train of thought is that perhaps that's why he was too embarrassed to talk about it, because they were, in fact, hashing out an alliance together, which really, really should never have been considered in the first place, considering what God expected from his people and how the Babylonians presented themselves and conducted themselves. Either way, Hezekiah does not answer, and silence sort of speaks volumes that he was certainly something went on that he was not proud about, whatever it was, but he felt too ashamed, perhaps, to mention it to the man of God. The question, whence come they? Hezekiah said, they are come from a far country. So he's almost pleading, you know, they come from a long way away, but they're from Babylon. Now, Babylon, you know, we're not being racist, but they did represent the ungodly world. And they brought him a present. Who knows what the present was? Maybe it was something harmless. Maybe it was something that was just so Babylonish in its essence that he should never have received the gift. I'm not here telling you that we can't have unsaved, ungodly friends, because that goes against how Jesus ministered. Jesus didn't come for the well, he came for the sick. And he was criticized for hanging out with the publicans and the sinners. However, the glaring difference between Hezekiah and Jesus is that Jesus influenced the ungodly more than the ungodly influenced Hezekiah. So please don't take my words out of context, that we should shut out all people who don't believe what we believe and just cut them off because they might be bad to us and be a bad influence. No, our faith should be strong enough that we are able to interact with them on a daily basis and love them and share with them, but hopefully give them a portrayal of what a Christian should be. But where do they come from? They came from Babylon, and this is a problem because of the welcome that Hezekiah gave them. Isaiah follows up with the knockout question, what have they seen in your house? Verse 4, what have they seen in thine house? Hezekiah answered, all that is in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. And what were his treasures? You go back to verse 2, and it shows everything. His house of his precious things, silver, gold, spices, ointment, all his armor, so his military might, all his treasures. There was nothing in his house, nor in his dominion. So this was an extended tour. Plenty of opportunity to turn the conversation to God's goodness, or, hey, while you're here, why don't you come to the synagogue with us, or however they did it back then. But he didn't do that. He got caught up in pride, and this is what we've got. He opened the door to the devil, essentially. He invited the devil into his house, and it wasn't to discuss theology. It was a giant waste of time. It could only end one way. Even if this wasn't a bad decision from a tactical point of view, because of the monster that Babylon was becoming, it was a shallow, meaningless interaction of no eternal value. And the Jews being an incredibly spiritual people, it sort of boggles the mind that Hezekiah, and who was a very godly man, would not choose to, at least in all the dominions, show them, you know, their books of the law and their relationship with God. He chooses not to do that. So these are the searching questions of Isaiah. We know that this was a stupid mistake, but because of Isaiah's questions, we can actually see that this was a very serious mistake. So point 3 is the seriousness of Hezekiah's stupid mistake. Why is it so serious? If we go a bit deeper, it was a seriously stupid mistake. 2 Chronicles 32:31. You don't need to turn if you don't want to. I'm just going to read one verse there at the moment. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. What is this wonder that was done in the land? Back in Isaiah 39, verse 1, we have the clue there. This king with the name sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. So, Hezekiah has been very sick and has recovered. And somehow, this illness that he recovered from gained enough, it was significant enough that all the way in Babylon heard about it and sent people to find out about how this had happened. Let's say this wasn't a common cold, this was a deathly illness. And we know that this was a deathly illness, because if we just go back to the previous chapter, you don't even have to be a great detective just to go back one chapter, the start of Isaiah chapter 38. In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came unto him and said unto him, thus saith the Lord, set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. Then Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed unto the Lord and said, remember now, O Lord, I beseech thee, how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight. And Hezekiah wept sore. He was going to die, and he was sad about this. God basically gave him something that he doesn't give a lot of people, and he confirmed that this illness is what's going to kill you. So Hezekiah, he just kicked stones, he wept because he was upset, but he brought it before the Lord and he prayed and said, Lord, look at my track record, please give me more time. Perhaps he feared for the future of Israel because they were in a very, very dark place at that time, and he was sort of a ray of sunshine, and justifiably probably didn't have very high hopes for those who would succeed him. And if you read more about the kings, you'd know that it was a disaster after Hezekiah passed away. So he brought it before the Lord, and he begged for more time. And God was inclined to acquiesce to his request. Verse 4 of Isaiah 38, "Then came the word of the Lord to Isaiah, saying, Go and say to Hezekiah, Thus saith the Lord, the God of David thy father, I have heard thy prayer, I have seen thy tears. Behold, I will add unto thy days 15 years, and I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city." So he's been given a guaranteed 15 more years, which is incredible considering how close he was to death. It's money in the bank. It's 15 years and peace in my days. I don't have to worry about those pesky Assyrians. So if it was Hezekiah trying to make an alliance with Babylon, this is just very, very forgetful. Perhaps it was the other way around, but still, again, he should not have been associating with such a vile enemy. And perhaps he had good intentions. Maybe I can bring God's blessing over to them. I can change them. It didn't work out that way. They influenced him far more than he influenced them. So, God heals Hezekiah miraculously, and he, of course, is thankfully very, very thankful, as you would hope that you would be. So the rest of the chapter, from Isaiah 30, verses 9 all the way to the end of the chapter, is a song that he wrote. I hope that he was musical, but even if he wasn't, he was overcome with gratitude, and he wrote a song praising the Lord for what he had done for him. And I won't read all of it, but verse 19 is probably one of the highlights, probably the bridge before the final chorus, not sure, but the living, he shall praise thee as I do this day. The father to the children shall make known thy truth. I'm going to tell the world what you've done for me, is what he's saying. He's got no problem telling his children, as he said, and him being the father of the nation of Judah figuratively, he had no problem telling about his goodness. They all knew about it. But when the Babylonians came along, again, we've read they were inquiring about this one. They were genuinely interested in how this was possible. He shut up about it. No mention of it at all. And this is why it's such a serious mistake. Because God set him up for the volleyball spike, and he chose not to jump for it. It was right there. All he had to do was just tap it, and he would have been a great witness to the ability of his God. But he doesn't do that. And this is why it's such a serious mistake. He gives all glory to God amongst the people, but not when an outsider comes in. When an outsider inquires why this happened, the hope and the thankfulness that he's so prominent about, it just disappears. I'm not going to tell them. They're not going to like me. They've come all the way here. They brought this really nice present. It's going to be awkward because they don't believe what we believe. I'm just really glad that I'm friends with them, and maybe over time, have you heard these rationalizations before? Have you made some of these? I know that I definitely, definitely have. So, this is the seriousness of Hezekiah's mistake. But to top it all off, point number 4, we're going to look at the selfishness of Hezekiah's reaction to judgment. Now, I realize that this one, depending on how you interpret the passage, this one can be interpreted either way. And done a bit of reading, and commentators are split, basically 50-50, on whether Hezekiah demonstrated selfishness or whether he didn't. But we'll just have a look at it now, and hopefully be able to see either side of it, but the side that we're going to focus on here. So Isaiah, after he hears, you know, what a mess Hezekiah has made out of it, that he hasn't bothered to declare God's goodness, that he's invited the devil into the house, and they've left with all the information about the kingdom of Judah, which they would use against them in future years. And Isaiah comes to him and hands down God's judgment. Verse 5 of Isaiah 39. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day, all the stuff that he showed off about, shall be carried to Babylon, because they've seen it now, they want it. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. and of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then said Hezekiah to Isaiah, good is the word of the Lord which thou hast spoken. He said moreover, for there shall be peace and truth in my days. Half the commentators are saying, now give Hezekiah a break here. He's actually being really, really submissive. And he's saying, all right, God, what you've said is good. And at least there'll be peace in my days. However, the other side of the coin is that the other half are saying, this shows Hezekiah's attitude was still not quite right. And while he's submitted to God's judgment, he was just going to enjoy his last couple of years on earth and know that there was going to be peace. So, I don't know for sure which one it was. However, it can easily be seen how it could be taken as selfish. And because we can often be selfish, I think we can still gain an application from this. His attitude, verse 8, good is the word of the Lord, there's going to be peace in my days. So, perhaps he's just glad that he's not going to be around to see the mess that he's created. At the moment, things are great with Babylon. God's told me I'm going to have peace with my enemies while I'm alive, so I don't have to worry about that. And he knew exactly how long he had. Now, I've often thought, you know, there's a saying that each year we pass our birthday and we remember it, but each year we also pass the day of our death and we never know about it. And that's true. And I think it's the age-old question, if you knew how much time if you had left, or if you knew this was your last day on earth, what would you do with it? Last year, last week, whatever time frame you want to give, what would you do with it? And, you know, answers may vary. A lot of people would like to think that they would use it really, really profitably and make the most of everything. I can see people doing that if they only had a number of days, but when you've got 15 years and you're the king of Judah and life is good and you are very rich and Babylon likes you and give great presents, it's also easy to see how you could really just bludge. I've got 15 years. I'll right some wrongs along the way, but things are going to be pretty good. What did God say when he originally told him that he was going to die? He said, get your house in order. Things weren't great. His son Manasseh became king, and that was a disaster. He still had work to do, and perhaps he chose to focus on that. I don't know. But I think the point is that him knowing how long he had was a double-edged sword, and that he didn't choose to use it wisely, and it's only after this acknowledgement that he would have longer that his pride came out and his lackadaisical approach to sharing God's message with the unsaved or the unbelievers. This all came about from knowing a locked-in time period that he had. It's probably a good thing we don't know when we're not going to be on this earth anymore. We're supposed to be living every day like it is our last, whether the Lord returns or we pass from this earth. But Hezekiah really was a pretty great guy. He was a great king. I'm saying all this, but we don't want to give him too bad of a rap because he did some great things. Now, if you want to turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 32, they sum up his life very well. And I want to read these couple of verses because this is going to get to the application part of the message. 2 Chronicles chapter 32, starting from verse 24. Sorry, no, my mistake. 2 Chronicles 32:24-32. Okay, we'll go from verse 27. And Hezekiah had exceeding much riches and honor. And he made himself treasures for silver and for gold and for precious stones and for spices and for shields and for all manner of pleasant jewels, storehouses also for the increase of corn and wine and oil and stalls for all manner of beasts and coats for flocks. Moreover, he provided him cities and possessions of flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him substance very much. This same Hezekiah also stopped the upper watercourse of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David, and Hezekiah prospered in all his works. So he prospered because he was a good king. God blessed him with material wealth and peace because he'd done many, many great things. And if you're not quite sure about that, you do a study on Hezekiah and all the great things he did up until this point. He really was a very, very godly king. But, verse 31, howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land. God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. And this extra 15 years that he was given gave him a selfish attitude, a selfish behavior. It's my farewell tour. I'm going to glory in what I've achieved, what I've accomplished. And if I don't influence anyone else for God during this time, I'm okay with that. And it was, if this was indeed his action, it is a selfish action. Especially because it would appear in verse 31 that the Babylonians genuinely wanted to know. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land. So whether they had ulterior motives or not, they came because they were perplexed how this king could have gone from being circling the drain to thriving and prospering. What's the reason? Our gods don't do this. He had a golden opportunity and he let it go. So, application time. You know, I would like to propose that Hezekiah, if we take Hezekiah's life as the model of a Christian life, he's a pretty good Christian. He's a good man, he's moral, he's hardworking, he's honest, he has a lot of Christian traits. However, there's also a Christian trait that he possesses that so many of us possess, and that he had zero desire to witness to the unsaved, to the unbelievers. And this is so many Christians today. I call him a Christian's Christian because he does all the right things when he's in like-minded company amongst other Christians, but when he has the opportunity to engage with someone outside of the circle of believers who are asking, genuinely asking, he did everything he could to avoid the topic. They came asking, and all he did was show them wealth and prosperity. Look how great we are, guys. And they saw how great it was, and they came and took it all. Everything he could to avoid the topic. I'm not talking about Christians who occasionally fluff our witnessing opportunities, and we try, and the words get jumbled, and we come away from it going, you know, I didn't say that as well as I could have. But that's okay, because the Spirit works, and it's not our words. But we attempted. This is someone here, and perhaps someone is you, or me, who, when it's right there, well, I don't want to talk about that. The senior Bible class did their item last year at the Sunday School Awards Day. It's called Opportunity Knocks at the Water Cooler. And it was about a Christian who, again, was a Christian's Christian, but he knew all this stuff, and he did have a reputation. But when someone genuinely came and asked and begged, he did everything he could to change the subject because he didn't feel comfortable talking about it. And I thought it was a really, really well thought out item, because it made you uncomfortable, and it needs to make us uncomfortable, because I feel like this is so many of us. We all do it. You know, are you a person who prays for the unsaved? Do you even do that? If you do, great. But are you then someone who prays for that unsaved person? You know, my unsaved friend, Lord, please send someone to talk to them. Well, that's you. You're that person. You don't have to be the one to bring them to Christ. God may not choose to use you, but you do have a responsibility to share what you believe with them and not pretend it's not there. You know, there's this attitude, and I've heard it so much, and I know the words have come out of my mouth myself. When we talk about how bad the world's going to get and when God's judgment comes, I know I've caught myself saying it, and other people have said it, doesn't matter, we're not going to be here. And that's a really, really, really bad attitude. That's a really sad attitude to have. Because, yeah, we might not be here, but all the unsaved will be here. And we're going to be gone. So, for a while there, they're going to be without hope and a witness. And we're excited that we're not going to be here for that. Now, please, if you've ever said that before, I'm not questioning your motives, but some people genuinely, you know, it's the, who's the Antichrist going to be? What country is going to come from? It doesn't matter, we're not going to be here. I'm not condemning us for talking about that. There's a difference between that and oh boy, the whole world's going to suffer and die and go to hell, and at least we're not going to be here for that. I would propose that that's a really, really selfish attitude to have, and we can do better and we need to do better. If we're not going to be here, that's great, but let's not cash in on our inheritance yet. We've got work to do while we are still here. Shame on us if we do have such an attitude of, I can't wait to get off this planet and just be, you know, whatever it's going to be up like up there, I'm ready to go. That's good to look forward to heaven, but not at the expense of, I can't deal with these people, I can't talk to these people, they're so hard, they're mean to me, they tease me, and I don't know what to say to them. That's a bad attitude to have. Let's look at Hezekiah's judgment. This was a very heavy price to pay for showing some people around and not really telling them about God's goodness. You know, it might seem like that at first, but was it really? You know, again, let's look at the punishment in verse 6 of Isaiah 39. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That's a pretty heavy, heavy price to pay. Why? Because he let the Babylonian, the picture of the world, influence him more than he influenced them. They did not leave mulling over whether the God of the Jews was the one true God. That's all it would have taken. But it didn't do that. And Hezekiah's pride was brought, which is a very Babylonian thing to have, because Nebuchadnezzar, again, was judged for his pride. So we know that this is a Babylonian trait. He let the world influence him more than he influenced the world. And it's a surefire way for our future generations, of our families, our kids and our kids' kids, to be not there when it's counted. If little by little, each generation lets the world get in more than we get out into the world. I hope you understand what I'm saying there. I often mention the example of Lot, and you've heard it before, but it haunts me, and so I use it constantly, that Lot, a righteous man, when he was told that God's judgment was coming, went to his sons-in-law and told them, we've got to get out, God's going to destroy this city, and they laughed at him, because they thought he was telling a hilarious joke, because they'd never seen in Lot this sort of behavior before. They didn't know what he believed. You know, he was just like them as far as they were concerned. And Lot lost everything and ended up in the mountains having babies with his daughters because he was such a poor example of a believer and didn't take the opportunities when they were there. This was such a severe judgment, I believe, because it was the perfect setup. They came because of a miracle to ask the nature of the miracle. He changed the subject. You know, it's the equivalent of, as you know, missing that spike, missing that home run which was lobbed underarm, missing that open goal to win the World Cup, being over the try, which happened last week, by the way. Newcastle Knights player received a perfect pass and ran over the line. All they had to do was put it down. It was 4 metres over the line, and someone ran in and knocked the ball out of his arms. And he was very embarrassed, as he should have been, because it was the perfect setup, and all he had to do was follow through with it. Hezekiah had a lot going for him, as faithful Christians do. If you're obedient to the Lord, then you will have a lot going for you. You will have a lot to offer the unsaved world. Don't give the excuse that I just never have any opportunities. Because if you are living for the Lord in an unsaved world, and you are rubbing shoulders, and you are showing the love of Christ, and you are being friendly and investing time in them, as we are commanded to do, and we follow the example of Jesus, then opportunities do come. And I know that for a fact. I've been given so many opportunities. And have I taken all of them? No. But I can testify that the opportunities definitely do come. So let's not waste them. We don't want to be just Christians. Christians around Christians, but noticeably absent when we haven't got our support network around us. I want to encourage us to be worldwide Christians. That's what I want us to be. What I want myself to be, and my hope and prayer for all of us is that we be Christians, not just here, but everywhere. Not the judgy, preachy, holier-than-thou Christians that push everyone away by never showing the love of God. We've got standards, but we don't have love. I'm not talking about that. but I'm talking about someone who lives like a Christian, lives like Jesus. People gravitated to Jesus. And they will gravitate to us also, even if it's just to ask, what are you on about? That's an opportunity. I'm glad you asked. We've got to take the opportunities that are given just so we can give others the opportunity to come to Christ. You know, it's not about success. Praise the Lord, 20 people came to Christ this week because of my witness. It's not about that at all. But it's if you're given an opportunity and you in turn give them the opportunity to think about what they've heard and to think about coming to the Lord, then you have done what the Lord has commanded. And you'll be blessed for that, and who knows, they may come to Christ because of your actions. And that's reward enough in itself. You know, can you say, yes, I am a worldwide Christian? Great, if you can, praise the Lord. But are you more like Hezekiah than you first thought? Perhaps you really weren't. You didn't feel like you could identify too much early on, but perhaps as time has gone on, you've realized that actually I do have those behaviors and those traits, maybe not all the time, but definitely some of the time. Maybe there's that particular person who, you know, you're great at witnessing to everyone else, but you don't witness to that person, that particular person, because you enjoy the friendship you've got. You like the attention they give you. You enjoy the relationship you've got, and you know that just bringing religion into it would just ruin everything. Well, that's a Hezekiah attitude there, and we're not to live like that. Hezekiah was a great bloke who suffered a severe judgment because of his short-sightedness. So, do we influence the world more than it influences us, or is it the other way around? The question that Isaiah said, what have they seen in your house? That can be anything. What have they seen in your life? If someone's spending enough time with you, they should be able to see that you are different. It doesn't mean that they're going to throw themselves at your feet. What must I do to be saved? I tell you, that very rarely happens. But the opportunities will come, and we are to take them when they come. And if they aren't coming, perhaps we need to do something differently. Perhaps we need to live in a way that is more consistent with what the Bible has laid out for us. What have they seen in your house? Hopefully, they've seen someone who loves the Lord and lives it out in every aspect of their life. And a Christian's Christian doesn't do that. They only do that around other Christians. We need to be worldwide Christians, doing our best for Jesus every opportunity that we get. So, the hymn that we're going to finish with tonight is hymn number 636, Have I Done My Best for Jesus? That's the question, isn't it? The good thing about the Lord is that he's very patient and he gives many, many new opportunities. You may not get back some of the ones that you've let slip by, but he'll bring along other ones. That's all he can ask, is that we do our best for Jesus. So we'll stand and sing hymn number 636 after the introduction.